Welcome to the Tech Talk Show, an hour of news, views and discussion. Well, welcome to the show. I'm Steve Griffiths and I'm joined by, Dan. Sorry, Dan.
There we go. I'm back on. There we go. Dan Hawkes, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Dan. Sorry about that. And we're joined in the studio by Tom Keeping. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And welcome to the show. And we're going to talk to you in a minute, but we've got a few news items we're going to cover first of all.
Yeah.
And we've also got Harry and we've got producer Chris sitting in the corner. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
he does hate talking on the radio. But anyway, Dan, give us your first news item.
Okay, well, the first thing I've got is the Advertising Standards Authority is making some changes to what UK broadband companies can say in their advertising. So recently they've ordered them to make changes over their monthly to make their monthly charges clearer. But now they're going to ask them to remove descriptions such as speeds up to a certain amount. So the changes should come in 2017. At the moment, the ASA hasn't said what these changes are going to mean and how they're going to implement them. But
I mean, that it's a little bit better now we're on fibre optic, actually. Mm-hmm. We're pretty guaranteed on the speed we get because of this uncontested sort of issue. But there's nothing worse than you're thinking you're going to get 5 or 10 meg and, you know, always at 6 o'clock in the evening it drops to 1.
Now this is it. And the people in the rural areas are always the ones that you know, seem to be losing out in the digital divide, don't they?
Tom, do you have bandwidth issues where you are, or you're okay?
Yeah, I mean, in central Bournemouth, the internet's pretty good connection, but where I live at home, it can be pretty temperamental. So yeah. I really struggle to get some of the more laboursome work done from home. It's always got to be in the office.
Yeah, you're right. It is, you know, I think that's where it does constrain home working. Mm. It constrains rural businesses as well. So really important. Well, I've got a couple of stories. I'm going to start first of all, Dan, be careful. I'm going to start first of all with a great story that was featured yesterday on BBC News, actually. It's about the Autonaut. And you know we love an aerial drone on this programme.
You do like to drone, don't you?
Yeah, I do drone on. Well, I have found a company, actually they're based on the Sussex coast, who actually make sea drones.
Oh.
And these are unmanned vessels that are powered by sunlight. So they've got photovoltaic cells on them. And actually they can go for many, many weeks at sea. And what they can do is contain special equipment. So it could be, for instance, portable monitoring equipment. It could be video. It could be even vessel detection systems and things like that. But it looks amazing. They're silent. They have a large payload, and they're actually quite large. They can be quite large, and they can also do various things and actually stay in a set location, or they can move, or they can follow a set route. So great tech and some really great innovation there from Autonaut, and their website is autonautusv.com. Some great stuff there. Have you another story, Dan?
Yes. Yeah, so the only other thing I've got is that Google are launching their Earth VR. So it's linked into the Google Earth system, or you know, with the data sets, and you can zoom in and look at various sort of things like like the Eiffel Tower or Buckingham Palace. But it uses the HTC Vive headset rather than Google's own Google
Oculus.
Cardboard.
Oh yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Which is seems to be interesting because it might be an indicator that Google are going to make a move to purchase HTC because the new Google Pixel phones are actually made by HTC as well. So it could be
a bit of movement there. Mm. So what's the use of that? How's that going to go with the 3D view?
I think it's just another sort of application of VR. You know, what's quite interesting is that you can't, as well as sort of changing your perspective by moving your head, you're actually able to zoom in very much like as if you were, a satellite camera zooming in. So you hover over Buckingham Palace and zoom in and see who's having a party.
Tom, we were at the VR and AR show at XL a couple of weeks ago, and we've got a pre-record actually from there today. One of the big technologies around AR, augmented reality, and there were some great companies, Dan, weren't there at the show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that
was amazing.
You know, and I suppose by having 3D Earth vision or a 3D Earth map, you can put AR over the top of that, and that's going to give you fantastic content, I suppose.
Yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, great. I've got one final thing. This is not, it's sort of tech, but it's very basic tech, Dan, believe it or not.
It's Abacus.
Yeah, nearly. Yeah, that's what I was trained. Slide rule, actually. That's what I was trained with at school. Yeah. It's actually a paper bike helmet.
Wow. Okay.
And somebody has designed a paper bike helmet that you can put in your pocket and unfold. Mm-hmm. And it's actually won the Dyson Award this year.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Really, really good. I'm just going to get the name. I think it is the company is Eco Helmet. And it's actually designed for people who use bike sharing schemes.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, so you can just have one in your pocket, you can unfold it, and it looks like a Chinese lantern, actually. That's, yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic, though. What a simple, really, really simple design, but fantastic technology. And it saves when you're using some of the bike schemes like Boris Bikes in London or whatever, carrying a huge helmet around with you.
Do you know, I have no words to how amazing that is.
Anyway, I think that's where... Any more stories for me?
No, that'll do.
Okay. Well, we are going to stay professional.
Yeah.
And we're going to move to our first guest. So, Tom Keeping, and your company's called Keeping...
Keeping & Co.
Keeping & Co. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your company, Tom, and what you do.
So Keeping & Co. is a design agency. We say that we're a design agency enabled by developers because we've got a very strong digital backbone. And basically what we do is we work with a variety of clients, quite a large variety, regarding like kind of brand strategy, design, and their online presence.
So in terms of online presence... Mm-hmm. You're obviously heavily involved in website, but in more mobile or tablet media as well, developing for that?
Yeah, I mean, the last few years have seen us kind of start to... I mean, my background is more design, but I learned how to code when I was doing this on my own. And so we kind of... The first few clients were small websites, and we built a reputation around being able to build websites. So that's really the core still of what we do. But we put design first because user experience is extremely important to making successful online presences.
I mean, it needs to draw you in.
Definitely.
It needs to give you the content you need immediately or relatively quickly. And then it's about taking them further into the information and the product.
I mean, what we try to do is we work with our client to figure out exactly what message they're trying to deliver, and it's about making that as easy accessible as possible, and as apparent as possible without being, you know, too kind of in your face about it. It's about elegance and beauty. Yeah.
And how important is the visual image when you actually land somewhere and the written word? What's the balance between the two there? Because obviously visual draws you straight in, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my personal opinion is the visual is probably the first thing you need to get right. There's a lot of companies out there. There's loads of companies out there that have extremely capable digital assets and strong developers as well. But they take a development first kind of approach when it comes to their websites, and so whilst it might be extremely functional, it might not actually work for the user. So really from a visual perspective, I would say that's the kind of first thing you want to get right, and then getting the message across in as few words as possible, but making those words, you know, really, really clear is probably the best route.
Yeah. So tell us a few of the projects you've worked on. Tell us why you...
So, I mean, we've worked with a variety from like local Bournemouth tourism type projects, which kind of includes the local bids, through to London based firms, legal, finance, we've got clients all over the world now. So we've got, as well as having quite an epicenter in Bournemouth and London, there's the Isle of Man, Tokyo, in America as well. So and it really varies, but there's quite a we seem to be becoming more and more inclined towards hospitality and leisure. So there's lots of hotels that we're starting to work with, restaurants and other companies like that.
And I understand that you're involved in the Jurassica project, which...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really exciting project, very early stages. And I mean, I was lucky enough to meet the founder of the concept, Michael Hanlon, before he unfortunately passed away. The whole concept just sent shivers down my spine. It was sort of like watching Jurassic Park when I was a child again. And when he talked about the idea behind it, I mean, for people who don't know, it's a £100 million project to build the world's largest prehistoric visitor attraction over in Portland near Weymouth. And it's, you know, it's hugely exciting what they're trying to do there. They're taking a disused quarry, converting it into kind of definitely a digital experience of kinds, as well as many other types of experiences that they're going to be doing there. Yeah.
I mean, VR is going to be, could be huge, couldn't it, for the visitor experience there?
Yeah, certainly. And I presume with the, you know, with the quarry face, you're able to see the different strata of the rock. Absolutely.
I think they're going to try and do, I mean, what's really exciting about it, because my involvement there is very, very minimal at the moment. I mean, it's extremely, we've helped on some pretty kind of fast turnaround projects there, which have been extremely exciting to be involved with, and have involved brands and individuals, which you know people talk about on a daily basis, which is really exciting from our perspective. But so I've also been sort of present whilst conversations of just the really small finite details are being formed as to how they're actually going to build this attraction, which is very exciting. Yeah.
So you talked about the hospitality and leisure industry. What specifics are you seeing coming in terms of requirements, design from them? What are they?
I would say from sort of if you were looking at the hoteliers, then one of their main problems is the domination of the kind of the online booking platforms, which mean that they're heavily reliant on the fees that are involved there as well. So for smaller kind of bed and breakfasts and medium-sized hotels, the reliance there means that, you know, they're paying 10% booking fees on every transaction, and to try and kind of entice users to dealing with their own online presence and remove those fees is an important part of kind of making their websites and all of their other digital assets a success.
So they would need online booking functionality embedded within their own website, or does it that take is, them somewhere else?
I mean, that's definitely a way around the issue, but then you kind of end up thinking, well, how are we going to implement that functionality on a website without relying on one of those bigger platforms? You know, quite often you'll go on a website and you'll have a booking form, but it links straight through to
Trivago or whoever,
or booking.com or any of those. And even sort of on a lower level, the companies which people probably don't know about, but they're still offering to thousands and thousands of hotels their own sort of skinned booking engine, but they're still taking fees on that. So we're actually in the process at the moment of trying to figure out a way to offer a more affordable kind of way of receiving bookings online through your own sort of custom booking form, which would hopefully make it more achievable for the smaller and medium-sized hotels.
So is that just an embedded program form in format, like Achieve Forms or whatever, where you create, or is it actually linked to a database that the hotelier would run as well?
We're working with a couple of hotels to figure out exactly how it would it communicate with their own systems, because quite a lot of them, as with like banking as well and all of those, they're all kind of tied to legacy systems which are like, you know, implemented tens of years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the software that I've actually kind of come in contact with in these hotels is actually quite funny to look at and use. Absolutely. And so when you're trying to deal with more innovative technology, to get it to communicate to the more primitive technology is one of the biggest sort of challenges that we come across.
Because it's easy to get a plug-in to go to a website, but it's actually what you do with it after, with the information that comes out, and how that feeds into the company, I suppose.
Definitely. And I mean, making it making the management of your website user-friendly as well is something which obviously these like kind of content management systems like WordPress achieve. But then, because they're so widely adopted now, you've got quite large security implications with that. So if you're installing tens of plugins which are used by hundreds of thousands of people, then, you know, we need to find a way around that. So we kind of take a custom approach to that.
So in terms of building, it's the whole package around design. So, you know, you're looking at not so much the branding, it's more about the content and how you navigate through it.
Yeah, so what will tend to happen is we'll start talking to the client about how they want to present themselves online, but we'll actually probably start from a brand perspective. So it is very much about branding. We do a lot of logo design look at the tone of the voice of the company, how they want to present themselves to the user, because the communication, that conversation with the user starts from the second that they see your brand. And it needs to continue through to whatever kind of communication that they're going to continue to have with you.
Yeah, sure. So certainly from what you said earlier, you seem to have quite a clear idea of what you think makes a good website and a good marketing thing. And you mentioned the word, you know, you said elegant earlier.
Mm.
And then you've also got to balance that up with whatever the company's brand currently is. And they'll have ideas about what they want to do.
Oh, 100%.
And I guess some there's a balance to be made there.
Definitely. I think from what we need to be doing is offering value to the client, like experience and sort of our own impressions on what they're talking about, and hopefully guiding them in the right direction. But it's very much actually the other way around when it comes to where they go. You know, we just want to be holding their hand where, and taking them to where they want to be, or potentially somewhere slightly better.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, where you've got a particular brand, how do you tell them that it's not right?
That's kind of where I was going.
I knew exactly where you were going, Dan. So how can you...
That's a difficult one, yeah.
I mean, you go to a company and say, look, yeah, well, you're trying to... You're a boutique hotel in the on the South Coast.
Sure.
And your market is X, because you know the market is going to be that. How do you then say, well... your branding's completely wrong and you need to do this. Can you do that?
You can and you can't. I mean, there's actually two types of client that I deal with when it comes to that. One is if I'm working with someone who knows where their strengths are and knows, you know, that they need to be work on their brand, then actually that's kind of a catalyst for some quite exciting conversations from the get-go. Other times you deal with people who possibly are more strongly tied to their brand. It might be sentimentality as well, and there is a bit of value in sentimentality. You don't want to completely detach them from what that brand means to them. So I'm thinking of one particular case at the moment where we redesigned a logo and it potentially... Well, it definitely was a long way from where it wanted to be, but there was a story behind how it got there in the first place. You know, it was overnight. They drew this up and they had to quickly get some paperwork together to win this the biggest project of their lives. Mm. They don't want to lose that kind of part of it. So we've had to work quite closely with them. It's a long process.
Yeah. So I come to you. I've got my brand, and you give me some really good advice, and we tweaked it.
Mm.
What are the common mistakes that companies make when they're going to the next sort of level of digital and design? What do you see as common areas of mistake? When they're sort of obviously engaging your services and looking about developing what they do or the markets.
Yeah,
they
I would probably say just running before you can walk is something. Well, you know, there's an ongoing level of communication which we really want to be having with our clients. Once they've got the brand, it's not as sort of we walk away from them and leave them to it. We should really be helping them with where they go next. So sometimes I guess if that communication breaks down too soon, as in they kind of walk in a different direction before we've actually finished the one that we're on, the journey that we're on, that's probably the biggest problem.
How can I extend my reach? So I'm a company, I have a very good product, I have a very good branding. What would your advice be about, right, I want to extend, I want to reach new customers and new markets, where would you advise?
I would say that there's a few questions I'd ask to the client before I was able to kind of give them that advice, and it would be whether it would be dependent on if they're a products-based company, if they're, you know, they're trying to get booking through a platform, or they're trying to sell products online, or, you know, or even if it's more of an exposure thing, they want the brand to be exposed rather than actually any specific interaction happening. You know, maybe it's just a touch point that they're trying to achieve, and all those different questions would guide us to what platforms we would use to gain that exposure.
Yeah. And how important is social media? You know, what are you advising people at the moment in terms of social media? Obviously, it depends on their target market and their service,
definitely.
But what do you see?
I would say that a huge value of social media is that it's remarketing. So once a user's already engaged with your brand, then you can touch base with them again. It might be just a way of keeping that line of communication open.
Yeah. Mm. And you started the company when you were quite young,
sure,
and now you've developed it 5 years later into a sort of a growing agency with some, you know, really sort of big projects underway.
Mm.
Is there an interesting story to how it all happened? Or?
You can be the judge of it. I mean, I started when I was 16. I started at a sixth form just before. I probably did about 2 weeks there, and then I decided it wasn't right for me. So I left sixth form, much to the disappointment of my parents, and I was told to get a job.
Dan has constantly been disappointing his parents, haven't you, Dan?
Yeah.
Since birth.
I was thinking about myself when I was 16, and I think I was more annoying and had less money.
That really, really isn't possible, is it?
No, it's cool. So I was told to go get a job, and what I did is I looked at apprenticeships, and I found an apprenticeship at a local web development company, if you want to call it that. It was kind of a one-man band who employed an apprentice to sort of help out. And after 2 or 3 months of doing that and learning code with his help and also a little bit of self-teaching, I actually thought, you know, maybe I want to try this on my own. So I took the £300 that I had in my bank account. I bought a few business cards and a little bit, a hosting package to start hosting websites. So I went around all the local shops and hotels in the area and got 2 clients off the back of that and charged them a really small amount of money to build them a website. But, you know, I knew that I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I needed to learn. So spent hundreds of hours, 100 hours a week pretty much, learning how to code on my own, you know, at home. In my bedroom, and then it got to a point where it sort of stepped into a second bedroom as my office, and then from there I kind of employed the freelancer that I was outsourcing a lot of work to, which was about 15 months ago, and within 6 months we outgrew that first office and moved 7 floors up, and we're on an exciting growth path. But I think it's key at that point to emphasize the fact that it's not all about how many people we have sat in your office, and it's more about the quality of work that you're producing. So from my perspective, it's now about kind of we're a great number, and we've got a really highly skilled team, and it's now about kind of working with more and more clients that are aligned with our culture and our vision, and kind of getting a reputation for being, you know, for producing really good work.
Great. And it's lovely that you were recognised as well. Was it the what awards did you receive?
So it's the Beamer 100, I believe, Rising Star.
That was very exciting. I mean, I was listed in the Beamer 100 this year, which is, I think they put it as the 100 people to watch in digital. Rising Star category there. Thank you. And then the Wirehive Digital Leader shortlisted for that, I was really proud for that.
Did you
tell your parents or told you so?
they got there first, and they did that a little while back.
Well, that's interesting. But so you started quite young, but does that give like a pressure on you?
I think it actually gave me less pressure in the beginning. Less financial responsibilities was probably the way that I thought about it, and then definitely got to a point where I had quite a bit of financial responsibility, and I realised, you know, exactly where we were, but it's been great fun, you know, which is the main thing. You know,
great. So where can we get more information about your company?
So you probably take a look at our website, see what you think of that. It's keepingand.co, or you can find us on Twitter at keepingandco, and we're also on Facebook.
Brilliant. It's now time for this.
Okay. Okay, so we've got the unboxing now. This is where Chris, our producer, has sourced us some new product. We're going to have a quick look at it. It's a first look. We've not seen it before, and we're going to get our first impressions. And we're going to have a look at it in the room, and going to get views from our guest.
And Harry's got it on Periscope. Yep. So Harry is there. And he's going to keep us updated on any comments that come in. So
okay.
So first of all, what's the box look like?
So it's a white box with some grey and orange writing on it. It's called an iHealth Align. It's a glucose monitoring system.
Okay. So, Tom, in terms of a design, what do you think in terms of packaging and appearance?
It's not the worst I've seen.
No. It's, it's sort of clean and...
Yeah,
it looks quite modern. Yeah.
And it's got a picture of it being plugged into a an iPhone.
Okay.
Right, so inside the box, we've got, a number of... so they're injecting devices just to get some blood out of you. I hope we're not doing that in the office, are we?
No, you're safe on that front.
Okay. There's like a pen device.
That is the... looks like the injection device, is it?
Yes, no, that is, yeah.
Careful, Dan.
I think that is. Yeah.
Don't puncture yourself.
Don't puncture.
I think we were safer with a drone last week.
Yeah,
that's taken away from me.
We had a drone last week.
I've never opened anything with so many instruction books.
Right, throw those away, as always. Do you really think you would... How many are there? Three, four, five, seven?
Yeah, easily seven.
Seven instruction booklets.
They'll get rid of them.
I'm hoping they're different languages.
Do you think? Let's have a look. Are they? Are they?
They're probably disclaimers. If it's a health product, it's probably disclaimers. Oh, okay. So we've got there's a number of plastic wallets which I would suggest probably go with the Sharps devices to.
Okay. You can, maybe you need to read the instructions to find out.
Yeah, not really. Well, possibly. Yeah. There's some batteries.
Quite comprehensive. Presented in the box? Is there like an insert?
Not anymore.
No, it's gone. Yeah, we trashed it completely.
I'm trying to find it.
Tom, have a look at the branding of the cover. See what you think of the actual product.
So what's information on there, Tom? What's it actually say? So it's a glucose
monitoring system.
Monitoring system.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's got, and it is all the different languages, so we don't have to spend the next few weeks reading the
whole book. There's a lot of writing on that box.
There is quite a bit of writing, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So eye health, it's obviously for people with blood sugar issues.
Yeah, for diabetes and the sort of that. Yeah.
So actually, me and Tom are currently looking at an iPad. Other tablets are available. an app that eye health have.
Right.
And from what it looks like here, Tom, I'll give it to you and give us your opinion on what you can gather from the actual app itself.
So, we've got three steps to go through or something. You can manually input your measurement, or you can scan the QR code of the bottle of strips for smart tracking. So is that the stuff that we've just taken out of the box?
Yeah. So you can take a blood test.
Yeah, I think
it then analyzes the
blood sugar levels.
Mm-hmm. And I assume the app is the means to record it, is it?
Yeah, you've also got sort of statistics dashboard, and you can manage your history by the looks of things.
That's quite good, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe you've got a logbook where you can put in your diet, which is probably going to be quite interesting as well.
Yeah.
I think Harry's got a question. Harry?
Yeah, we've had someone ask, why so many batteries, do you think?
It obviously eats them.
Yeah. Maybe it's because it's a digital device. They can have quite a high voltage draw. But there's three that come with the...
Are they all in at once, or are they...
I don't know. They're all in separate bags.
So I would have thought one at a time, yeah?
Maybe they're just being very generous. You don't normally find that you get any batteries or things, do you?
No. And it plugs in via the jack, yeah?
So, yes.
So can you do data over an earphone jack?
Apparently so.
Must be able to.
Yeah, I think I've used something once before which has done that, yeah.
Oh, yeah? Have you? Yeah. All right, okay.
And you can see that something like this could be useful. So so my brother and a couple of my aunts are type 1 diabetics, so that's where they rely on insulin.
Yep.
But obviously people with type 2, it can be managed through diet as well as some medication.
Okay.
And so being able to track your blood sugar levels and keep a diary of your diet actually would probably be quite useful, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think it goes over all age levels as well, because you know, a lot of people might be listening thinking, well, how is my 80-year-old grandfather going to be able to operate an iPad and you know keep a track of all this this tech and all this? But again, it's for the family members too, for a peace of mind, because if you are looking after an elderly person and you wanted to keep track without writing down in a notebook constantly, you know, what their scores were for the blood test. You've got it here in front of you on the app.
It'd be quite interesting if you could share that data as well.
I assume you can do, actually. Yeah, I assume you would be able to
upload that to health professionals.
The thing with it, and I suppose it's quite a lot of these health things we've got, and then there's a phone in after the,
the pre-record, thinking,
so we'll talk about that, is one is about access and security. The other thing is, shouldn't we be getting that via our doctor or healthcare professional or whatever else, rather than buying one yourself?
Yeah, certainly. I think there's more, from what I understand from my brother, there's more smart devices being available, but they're still a cost to the NHS. And I think, you know, if you've got a child or something like this, this might be a good way of getting them, you know, because they're using a smartphone and, you know, using a bit of technology, it might get them a bit more bought into, you know, keeping a record.
Am I right in thinking that you have to monitor this anyway? So this is just a more intelligent way of monitoring this?
Yeah, it could be. Or your own, you just purchase it. I think we should find out exactly how much it costs.
Well, Dan, what do you think? For kind of bearing in mind that people with diabetes are given the actual... the testers themselves from their doctor. It's just the actual device that would allow you to record it that we have here. So on that note, what would you reckon?
I'm going to go for £45.
£45, okay.
Tom?
I was going to go for £35. I mean, you're probably going to have to keep buying those things that you've got to inject into yourself. So
Yeah, I suppose. I think because of the app, and that seems like a really good way to record things, and you can have a history, I think It's got to be 30 quid. It's got to be that £30.
Should we ask Harry?
Harry, what would you go for?
I'll go £20.
You always go cheap, Harry. Yeah. You always go cheap.
I'm a cheapskate.
So, Chris.
So, yeah, I think you'd be surprised. It retails at £15.99. Now, okay. I think that's just obviously the technology for the app, and the app is actually free.
So, to
download with all the statistics, etc. So I think you know, considering the price, if you do suffer with diabetes, then it's a good way of tracking your, like you said, like Tom pointed out, the diet and, you know, the levels and keeping a good track rather than, you know, just writing them down all the time.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Should we ask?
So we really should go.
Yeah.
Go
down. Does it go back in the box or does it rock?
I think that rocks.
Yeah, yeah. I'd agree with you. It's my first. It's rocks.
Really?
Yeah, that's the first one. I hated everything.
Yeah, you do. You're a hater. You're a tech hater. Hashtag tech hater.
Just
Dan.
Keep it Neolithic. That's as far as I go.
Yeah, Jurassic. The Jurassic Coast was about right for you, really, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's wrong with a test tube and a microscope or something?
Keep it analog. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. That's what your gaming's like as well, isn't it? I'm. Yeah, I'm definitely going to say it rocks as well, Chris.
Yeah, it definitely rocks for me. It sounds
Harry,
good advice.
Yeah, it rocks.
Great. So that's unanimous. I think that is the first time ever that we've had a unanimous it rocks.
I hope you're not blaming me for that.
Yeah, probably is actually. Tech hater. Great. Well, thanks for that. And we're now going to go to a pre-record, which we recorded a couple of weeks ago at Apps World, and it's a company called Transfer Go, and we'll hear from them now. So I'm here with Gusta from Transfer Go. Actually, we're just taking the mickey out of Dan's cravat. We think it's rather dandy.
Yeah, indeed it is.
That's very kind. I was wondering how long today it would take to come up.
Yeah, so we've been about an hour or two, and I cannot wait to just rip into you completely. But more about that later. There is a photo on Twitter with Dan with his rather beautiful cravat on. So Gusta, tell us a little bit about FireGo. Tell us what the company does.
So TransferGo is a low-cost international money transfer provider that provides close to real-time money transfers. And the interesting thing about us is that we basically send money internationally without actually sending money across the borders, because we use our digital account-to-account business model, which means as a user, you pay in locally into our local account, and we pay out locally from our local account in the recipient's country, which means we can cut the cost of the transaction up to 90% in comparison to their competitors and banks, for example, as well as we can offer the really fast money delivery. The fastest money delivery we've ever done is around 60 seconds. So
that's fantastic. I mean, I used to have a property abroad, actually a couple of properties, and I was always sending money abroad. And what used to annoy me was it was going to be 2 or 3 days before it would get there. And not only that, they charged me a fortune.
Yeah, definitely. So we knew about all these pains because one of the co-founders as well started the business. First, it was import-export business and literally dealt with the same problem. So we understand the pain of waiting for transaction, not knowing the real destination amount. So another problem that we fix is that we have fixed FX rates. So at the time of you making a transaction, we fix the FX rate and guarantee the destination amount. So despite any changes given the Brexit and all, despite any changes in the currency and any fluctuation, you know how much your recipient will get at the time of making a transaction. And we absorb all the kind of, you know, risk if there is any involved. Yeah, so that's why it's very good for end users.
Yeah, I mean, the fluctuations we're seeing at the moment, Dan, you could lose a fortune.
Absolutely. You could, you know, just £100 or something like that, you could lose in a transaction over €2 at the moment. So I'm interested. So obviously people are concerned about security around their bank accounts and transferring money out and using maybe a third party. How do you reassure people around that?
So one good thing is about that we actually use banking infrastructure. So we don't collect money into some kind of weird transfer go thing. We use bank accounts. So it's bank account from bank account. So people use their own online banking paying into our bank account in the UK, for example, and we pay out from regular bank in France to their bank account in France as well. So that's why it's purely, like, it's very secure. And obviously, as any fintech company, we are FCA regulated and we do all the checks necessary. So we do the identification and know your consumer. And sometimes we even need to check, let's say, for the larger amounts, proof of funds or address and all that. So it's 100% secure to use our service.
And now, obviously, you're using your account within the country of receipt. So how broad is your service at the moment?
At the moment, we serve over 45 countries, mainly Europe, but as well as we cover the US, India, recently launched Ukraine, and Philippines. So, because we also have a business section as well on our website, so we can allow people to, like, for businesses to also, I don't know, for like imports, exports, or pay their employees abroad and all. So that's why sometimes we need to, like, sometimes we open the corridor just actually to, you know, feel like to serve their needs.
So you do both private and business banking or exchange. Big issue for companies, isn't it, when they're paying staff abroad in the currency that's actually abroad?
Exactly, yeah. That we definitely noticed that it is our tool is mainly used, actually, if from business point of view, it's mainly to pay employees abroad or just pay for, like, some kind of imports, exports. And it is an issue because of the currency exchange, and that's where our fixed guaranteed amount really falls in, because if you have a salary of sort, you don't want it to not be paid fully or be overpaid as a business. So for us, giving opportunity to fix the amount that is going to be received despite any currency fluctuation in the meantime while the transaction is being made is very, very useful and, you know, needed for them.
So can companies forward fix the exchange rate as well, or do you just do on the day?
So for the companies, we have our staff, which is basically account managers, who can actually fix the effects for certain, like, companies depending on, let's say, the volumes of money they send and the value for them as well as us for a business.
So how do you see your business growing in the future in terms of presence, functionality?
So at the moment, we just launched our app. So it's mainly consumer-focused for the time being. And what we're going for is the smooth Let's experience. So we have, like, a hold to send button, which literally allows you to hold and send money. So that's, like, the smoothest and fastest you can go, really. So from the consumer's point of view, super fast, because there's one kind of tap, hold to send. And then from our business and from our back end is really fast as well, because we can, you know, send the money within our accounts really quickly. So this is just basically moving forward, we want to make real time kind of a global standard, because we know that we've started the first company that started this, but we want to go there and be actually, you know, teach others how to do it the right way.
Now, I know you're head of communications for the company. So what tip would you give to somebody? And you might, you know, might give yourself the tip. How do you maintain your market share?
For us and for business like ours, I believe what's very, very important is trust building. So that's where we always start from, and that's how we actually even gain the market share, and that's how we try to maintain it. So as long as you can, you know, address the community, you understand their needs, you know their pains, and bring the value to the consumer, and just build up on that. That's where we see the future.
And so you said the app's only, you know, sort of just gone live. Is there some, you know, one key thing you wish you had have known beforehand? Or is it like a tip that you can give other people just before the release of a new app?
That's an interesting question. I guess, yeah, from the communication point of view, I can definitely say that it requires so much more, like, punchier and very, very direct. Yet again, kind of, we still need to maintain our brand and be very personable. So just kind of mix and match those two. It's still a bit of a learning curve to, you know, using less words, but it's kind of conveying the same emotion and message. That's, you know, what we still need to work on.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Okay. So, I'm just wondering, you know, where can we find out more about the company if we need, you know, if we want to?
Yeah, please visit www.
Sorry, just if Dan needs to send any of his fortunes abroad,
yeah.
Maybe hide it in a little offshore account somewhere, how would he find out more information?
Yeah, you can always visit transfergo.com and as well as download our app at the App Store as well.
Superb. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So there we go. That was about money and how to send it abroad, Dan.
Yeah,
so,
and I only wore that cravat that day to stop people picking on you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, took the pressure off me. Well, we're joined on the phone by Andrew Kirkby. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Great, and great to hear you. Thanks for joining us. Adaptive Apps, tell us a little bit about your company and what you do.
Certainly. We're a software product development company, and we build a range of clinical apps for use by healthcare professionals such as GPs, community nurses, paramedics, etc. And what our apps do is they provide sort of accurate information about a patient's healthcare and their medical records at the point of care, whether that's in a GP practice, a clinic, or a patient's home, you know, wherever that information is required.
I mean, it's extremely important for all those involved in the care of individuals to know the history, isn't it, of what's gone on and how they access that, I assume, would have been through paper records.
Primary care, as it's referred to in the UK, so GP and community care, has been sort of well served by IT for a long time. But that's been sort of, you know, the traditional desktop model and the notion of you going to see your GP and them sitting behind a desk and working away on a device. Really what we're doing is turning that almost inside out and saying, right, more and more the NHS wants professionals out there in the community. A pencil and paper is no good.
No, exactly. No good. Yeah, and also it's about having it in a mobile environment, I assume.
Absolutely.
So what are the challenges about that in terms of providing that information at any point of contact with the patient? How difficult is that to do?
Well, I mean, fundamentally what we're about is, you know, we think we're in an era now where people's expectations of how technology should serve them in the workplace are increasingly being driven by their experiences of technology outside of work, whether that's their smartphone, their TV, their tablet, and that's really what we're embracing. We use a lot of modern technologies, a lot of modern design techniques in what we build, which delivers things that are a lot more like the kind of consumer experiences that people have. But that does mean it's very different to the legacy software systems, the old hardware, the old software that they're used to working with day in, day out. So that change, whilst it's a change for something that they see as being ultimately better and serving them a lot more usefully, it is nonetheless disruptive.
So I know that you aim to keep your all your apps updated frequently, but the mobile environment is quite volatile, isn't it? And particularly, you know, with new devices coming in, OS updates, you know, from Apple or from Google. So managing across that across all users must be quite a challenge. How do you manage that?
So well, certainly that was one of the things we had to think hard about in the early days of our company when we were setting up. So we made a set of technology choices and decisions that allow us to have, you know, most of the software that we develop, about 80% of it is common across all of the different platforms that we run on. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, as we change it, modify it, add new capabilities, we only have to do that in one place. And the app stores allow us to get it out there very quickly and very efficiently. In ways that our end users are just not used to experiencing previously. But it does mean we have to track very closely new operating system versions, especially in the Apple iOS space, make regular reviews and decisions. We're just going through some now where we're updating what the minimum OS versions will support. So we're about to change. Right now we support Android 5 and everything later for our Android app. We're about to change that, so it'll require a minimum of version 5 of Android. Otherwise, the test matrix just gets too complex.
Yeah, I can imagine. And so, you know, the apps for sort of people out in the community and could be visiting, you know, people in all sorts of locations. And I guess there's potential for, you know, poor data signal areas. And where, you know, data is being recorded on the device, there must be issues with sync issues. Is that right? Or
one of the design principles from the outset was to try and deliver as much of the app's functionality without requiring either a wireless or a cellular data connection. Mm-hmm. So we have what we call an offline first architecture.
Okay.
It does some clever things in terms of understanding what your appointment schedule looks like. And caching in a very secure fashion the patient records you need on the device, mm-hmm. such that when you leave the practice and you go out into the community, if you lose that connection, the chances are you have the information you need on the device already, and then as soon as you're back in range, that information is automatically synchronized with the cloud.
Brilliant. Okay.
And what about security? Obviously, that's a really great concern around health records and health information. How difficult has it been able to first design and link into some very, very secure systems, but then also to keep that updated? How hard has that been?
Well, certainly, you know, getting certified to deliver apps in this space means you have to adhere to a fairly rigorously defined set of requirements, information governance and security requirements that, you know, flow down from the NHS. So those have been implemented and we've been assessed. And then, you know, we require on a broad range of web services to enable the different features our apps have. And the suppliers of those web services themselves, you know, have to run on the NHS secure networks and implement a pretty complex set of requirements in terms of how they make their services internet facing.
Interesting. Yeah, and so I understand that you've had quite a sort of career within different roles and different big names in technology, including 25 yeah. years in Microsoft.
Yeah.
How did you sort of move from sort of, you know, to sort of, you know, software development and that into the healthcare sector? Was that intentional or?
Very much so. I mean, one of the roles I had at Microsoft was I ran a healthcare solutions practice for about 6 years. We were working very closely with the NHS and a number of its suppliers, really looking at how, in that case, Microsoft technologies could you know, improve clinical safety for the kinds of systems that Adaptive Apps is actually now building. And that was a a great period in my career at Microsoft. We learned lots of things, and it really set the seeds in my mind of, right, you know, when I left, what was I going to do next? And I had a hankering for some time to really want to get back to what got me into the industry in the first place, which was, you know, designing great software and getting it out there into people's hands.
And then, obviously, self-monitoring and remote monitoring of health issues is a very large growing market. I mean, we've seen and discussed here information about, you know, heart, rest, sleeping, monitoring, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
How do you see that going in terms of the market extending and how would you see yourself in that marketplace as well?
So certainly, you know, what I would call, if you like, patient-facing or citizen-facing healthcare apps, whether that's telemedicine or telemonitoring or just, you know, access to your own personal health record, was part of the market that we considered, you know, back into the 2013 timeframe when we were setting the business up.
Yeah.
But our conclusion was then, and I think still now, it's a very, very crowded space. There's a lack of standards and regulation. And what we thought at the time, and we still believe is the case, actually the area that was being overlooked was the software that our doctors, our GPs, our nurses have to use on a daily basis to treat us.
Yeah,
which is why we ended up taking the focus we have. And in terms of our product roadmap, you know, we see probably at least another good 2 years or so just continuing to add in all of the capabilities into you know, the apps that we put into the market, you know, just to serve the people we're trying to help right now. So it's not something that's an immediate focus for us.
And also, I mean, the number of employees within the health environment, I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people would be working within the healthcare, you know, personal care environment. So the market there is massive in terms of the number of people that would or could need to access records.
It's growing all the time, and certainly, you know, the NHS and how it's trying to change how care is delivered is requiring more and more roles, if you like, to be able to access you know, different parts of that patient record. Yeah, so we see our usage growing,
and that's
continually.
And that can be a hierarchy of permissions and access as well, I assume.
So role-based access and only being allowed to see what's appropriate for your role is a very key part of the whole experience.
And is that contained within the app, or is that something that the core database undertakes?
So we have we do everything through a mixture of private and public cloud web services, and the things that you just described there come very much out of the web services, out of the secure NHS network and the private cloud there.
Yeah.
So it's very much cloud-driven, you know, data-driven or web service-driven, however you want to describe it.
So one of the things that I understand that Adaptive Apps can do is record observations, the health professionals' observations on a patient on the app.
Yep.
and we're seeing a bit more in the NHS with patients being, you know, having some sort of something to take home with them. We see with blood pressure monitoring kits. Do you see any sort of involvement with adaptive apps or you know, something, a patient app where they could take it home and then upload sort of information about what they're doing with their diet or you know, anything like that to directly into their medical record?
I think what we'd look to do there is rather than delivering that service directly, is look to see, you know, who in the market establishes, you know, if you like, trusted repositories or services for capturing that information. You know, Microsoft had a go at it a few years ago with something called Health Vault. Google have tried something similar, but none of those have really taken off. And you have some, you know, there's some really difficult challenges about taking information that a citizen or a patient records about themselves and then deciding how do you import that into what is, if you like, the professional medical record, and being able to distinguish things that are information that have been recorded by a clinician versus, if you like, medical information that's been recorded by the patient themselves. Where we would probably look to do something similar or a little bit like that is if we look at the kinds of modern devices that we run on today, smartphones and tablets, is looking at manufacturers of monitoring devices, whether it's you know, blood pressure cuffs or those kinds of things, and saying how can we enable our app to integrate directly with those. So if the GP is visiting somebody in a care home, rather than having to type in their blood pressure or type in various observations, they could use small portable devices that are measuring those things and capturing that data directly from that device. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I think Tom wants to come in with a question. Tom's our other guest in the studio.
Hello. Sorry, it might be a silly question, but I'm just wondering, actually, if the medical professionals, for example, prescribed a something that the patient had to take on, say, a daily basis, would the app maybe start to take on the functionality of reminding them to take that? Could that be something that would happen in the future?
Certain, not our app, because, again, our apps are only used by the healthcare professionals themselves.
Sure. Okay.
But in recording that information into their record, and certainly some of the company, you know, some of our clients who take our technology and take our apps and then sell them on into the NHS, also provide patient-facing apps or services as well. So the information we record, they can then, you know, extract or play back if they wanted to put that kind of reminder functionality into their own apps.
Sounds great.
Just lastly, I've worked on quite a large number of public service projects, as you know, data projects and computer system projects. And one of the biggest issues was about multiple records for the same thing, or the same person, or the same premises. And I just wonder how you can ensure, or how you do ensure, that whoever's going to see somebody is actually inputting into the right record, or you know, they've got the right individual. Is that part of your app system?
Well, I think that that's a great question. And I think today the way that is addressed is through a combination of things. One is, if you like, the storage technologies and the back-end technologies that drive our apps and sit behind the web services that we use in terms of how they manage patient records and use things like the NHS number or the Scottish CHI number.
Yeah.
To be able to put a unique ID on every patient and to ensure that that's forms a core part of how information is retrieved and stored.
Yep.
And then there are other conventions in terms of user interface design and how people look at information on the screen.
Yep.
So you'll see on any view in our apps, there's a thing called the patient banner. It's actually an NHS standard. It always has to be there. It has to communicate certain pieces of information about that patient to help ensure that the person I have in front of me physically
is the right one
yeah, for the record I'm looking at in the app.
So it's almost like a secondary confirmation. Although you've got the record, there are certain key bits of the individual you'd be checking anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And obviously, you're available. What's your website address for Adaptive Apps?
AdaptiveApps.biz.
.biz. And obviously on the normal Twitter and other social media as well, yeah?
Yeah, we've got some present there, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
So, that's it. I mean, healthcare monitoring is a huge issue, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. And I think anything that's going to help provide, you know, time savings and efficiencies for the NHS, you know, it's got to be a good thing. And it's particularly a stretched NHS.
And Tom, you know, accessing information or accessing, you know, your actual products in a mobile environment can only grow, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've seen some pretty exciting sort of ideas as to where that could be moving in the future as well with how people can use that. I mean, because there's obviously this issue with self-diagnosis at the moment, but it's great to have this kind of starting to take presence in the industry with all this kind of informed diagnosis, yeah. You know, with the apps on the phones, that yeah. being able to actually access data.
And also we see, obviously, this online and offline input is quite a feature for a lot of recording databases and recording systems that we see now as well, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as long as you solve that syncing issue about yeah. you know, going in and out of different data sources or data areas, I think that's important. Great. Yeah.
And obviously super secure as well. So I think, you know, if you were taking, along with banking and we talked about the money, you know, money on the go sort of thing, that is, they've obviously taken technology from around those areas and made sure around patient record. So, Harry, what's going on social media, mate? What we got?
Yeah, I mean, I've been having a look in the last 10 minutes or so to see what people are getting excited about or angry about.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of bits of selfie news okay. I want to share with you.
Yeah.
So the first one, Coca-Cola have created a bottle where you can take a selfie while you're drinking.
So what's that, so inside your mouth or just as you approach the bottle?
How's
that
going to work?
Ideal for dentists.
Yeah, so the articles put it while you're sipping your health away.
Very Tom, very true, eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or rotting your teeth away, yeah.
I suggest that you go over to our Twitter and have a look because I've sort of retweeted the picture of it. So basically you've got your bottle and you're drinking it, and then at the end it looks like a little just a rubber attachment, like a holder. And built into that is a camera, so right. Brilliant for Coca-Cola and their sort of social media marketing.
So what it does is going to take a photo up, basically either up your nose
yep.
or into your mouth. That's about the two bits of selfie they're going to see. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not the most flattering of
Chris. Chris's got a rather large nose, a bit like myself. I mean, it's just going to block out most of the daylight, I think.
I think I'll trim those nose hairs before I buy one of those bottles of Coke.
Very true. What else you got, Harry?
The other bit of selfie-related news is a slightly lower tone. So the amount of people...
Oh, where's this going, Dan?
No,
I really don't know.
Tone,
you've got his microphone on control.
Yeah, I've got the control here, Harry. Don't forget.
So the number of people who die each year through taking a selfie is on the rise.
Really?
So, that
puts a new meaning to I'm dying to take a selfie.
In 2014, there was 15 selfie-related deaths, and that number's jumped to 73 in this year alone. So there's a company that are building some sort of software which can warn you, if your eyes can't do that already, that you're in danger when you're taking a selfie. Like when you're on a cliff top or, as one person tried to do, climb over a balcony. If your eyes can't do that, the app will.
Am I the only one that thinks this is natural selection?
Yeah, evolution.
No, that is so wrong, Dan. That is so wrong. Tom, do you like it? Are you a big fan of a selfie?
I don't know if I'm a big fan. I think no. They've become more of a normal thing, so it's probably more and more people are doing them. I wouldn't be surprised if three times the amount of people are taking selfies now. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe actually, yeah. It goes to show the more you strangle statistics, you can make them say whatever you want, basically, because you're right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And is that it, Harry? Nothing else?
Just one other little bit of exciting news.
Exciting? You sound really excited. Another bit of exciting news.
I'm not up with the local data storage laws in Russia, but apparently LinkedIn have broken them, and they've been blocked in Russia.
Yeah, no so, Rushki LinkedIn.
No jobs for you, Russians.
No, exactly right. Yeah, that's interesting how they completely shut a site down for a whole country. Unbelievable. And we see that a lot in China as well, obviously, in other places. Yeah. Well, great show, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And enjoyed that. I know you came a long way to be with us.
No, it's a pleasure.
And it was great to hear about what you're doing and the design work you do.
So
thank
you very
much. Amazing. Cheers, Dan.
Thank you, Steve.
Great. And look forward to everybody joining us next week.